From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today we take a look at the radical mind of Dick Cheney, who some call the most powerful U.S. vice president in history. The U.S. lifts a decades-old ban on research into low-yield nuclear weapons. We'll speak with the Los Alamos Study Group about the development of mini-nukes. We'll talk with two fathers whose children are deployed in Iraq. One of them is traveling to Iraq this week. And more fallout from the, quote, Miami model, how the Miami police dealt with those who do not agree with the FTAA. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Steelworkers of America is calling for the firing of Miami Police Chief John Timoney following last week's protests against the free trade area of the Americas and the dropping of all charges against peaceful protesters. The mostly peaceful protests were marred by scores of reports of police brutality. Police shot rubber bullets and tear gas at protesters, beat demonstrators with batons. Over 200 people were arrested and jailed. At least one protester remains hospitalized from injuries he said he sustained at the hands of the police. The AFL-CIO and the American Civil Liberties Union are considering suing the city. And the president of the Steelworkers Union called for a congressional investigation into why $8.5 million from the Iraq Reconstruction Bill was used to pay for, quote, security at the protests. He said the money went towards, quote, homeland repression. The Alliance for Retired Americans also held a rally Tuesday in Miami to protest how the police handled senior citizens who attended the FTAA demonstrations. One 71-year-old man, Bentley Kilman, told the Associated Press he was arrested while he was looking for his organization's bus. But then he encountered police dressed in riot gear. They pushed him to the ground, arrested him, handcuffed him for 12 hours, denied him water or a chance to make a phone call. Kilman said, quote, "The way I was treated, you would expect it in a third world country, not in this country." Miami police continue to defend their actions. A spokesman told the Associated Press, quote, "The object of the show of force was twofold. One, to let the peaceful demonstrators know they could protest safely, and two, to let the troublemakers know we would not tolerate anarchy. It was successful," unquote. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Tuesday approved President Bush's package to overhaul Medicare by a 54-44 vote. The legislation is meant to help provide the nation's 40 million Medicare recipients help pay for prescription drugs, but critics say it'll give billions to private medical companies and lead to higher medical costs and the privatization of Medicare. Senator Edward Kennedy blasted the bill, saying it'll, quote, force senior citizens into the cold arms of HMOs. A new Los Angeles Times poll found only 33% of seniors polled backed the new bill. In other news from Washington, the government reported yesterday the economy grew at an 8.2% annual rate last quarter. It was the fastest rate since 1984. In Iraq news, Jay Garner has admitted in an interview with the BBC that the U.S. made a series of mistakes during his short stint overseeing the U.S. occupation of Iraq before he was replaced with Paul Bremer. Garner said the U.S. should have communicated more efficiently with the Iraqi people, restored electricity quicker to the country, increased the number of troops in Baghdad, and worked harder to establish an Iraqi government. The New York Times is reporting the White House has decided to take back nearly $300 million in loan guarantees to Israel to punish Ariel Sharon for building new settlements and a massive wall through Palestinian land in the West Bank. A record 3 million people with AIDS have died this year across the globe, including 500,000 children under the age of 15. Meanwhile, the total number of people infected with HIV has grown to 40 million as the virus is spreading more quickly in places like India, Russia, and China. This according to a report issued Tuesday by the organization UNAIDS. However, UNAIDS did report the infection rate is falling in portions of Africa. In a rare interview, former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet described himself yesterday as a, quote, angel. After he took power in a U.S.-backed military coup in 1973, he oversaw the killing of at least 3,000 dissidents and political opponents. He added, quote, I never aspired to be a dictator because I considered that to be a dictator would end badly. I always acted in a democratic way, unquote. Between 1998 and 1999, he was held under house arrest for 17 months in Britain on charges of genocide.
Voices on the radio tell us that we're going to war. Those brave men and women in uniform, they want to know what they're fighting for. The generals want to hear the end game. The allies want to prove the plan. Just don't give a damn, 'cause it's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil. Blood, sweat, tears, and toil. It's all about the price of oil. Evil then than he is now. The stock market holds the answer to why him, why here, why now. 'Cause it's all about the price of oil. It's all about the price of oil. Blood, sweat, tears, and toil. It's all about the
price of oil, Billy Bragg, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today we take an in-depth look at the radical mind of Dick Cheney. The cover story of this week's New Republic examines the historical role Dick Cheney has played in U.S. foreign policy and his influence on George W. Bush. We're joined by Spencer Ackerman, assistant editor at the New Republic. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to have you. Why don't we start from where you begin, tracing the odyssey of Dick Cheney, going back to the first Bush.
Well, what we wanted to figure out when we undertook this project was why someone who many people thought in 2000, when he became the Republican vice presidential nominee, would be a voice of advocacy for stability and in general realpolitik, like the first Bush administration generally was, became someone who was so eager to reverse what many consider in retrospect sort of the central aspect of the Bush administration, in the first Bush administration's foreign policy, which was essentially ending the Gulf War with Saddam Hussein in power. And the more we looked at Cheney's record in the Pentagon, the more we saw that he wasn't within the mainstream in that first Bush administration. He was more of its ideological outlier. when it came time to formulate policy toward the Soviet Union during the waning days of the Cold War, Cheney wasn't interested, like his colleagues James Baker or Brent Scowcroft or even the first President Bush, in arms control or supporting Mikhail Gorbachev and sort of bringing the Soviet Union to what some would call a soft landing. He wanted to really press a very radical approach, and sort of shock the system by supporting uprisings in the rebellious Ukraine to create something of an outpost in the region that he would hope would become something of a linchpin for democratic transformation. And similarly, support Boris Yeltsin, who would then challenge the regime at its core. And you can hear some of the overtones in the Iraq War today. Looking at that, there would be the end of about 40 years worth of ideological confrontation that would be solved on the United States' terms if we first found someone we could support. Who would have our interests at heart in this figure that they would convince themselves was a world historical figure like Yeltsin. And similarly, creating an outpost in the region would then provide a foothold through which the ideological problems of the region, communism in so many words, as it was falling down in the end of the 1980s, would then provide this sort of regional positioning towards which the region would then sort of look more like the United States and sort of an open, liberal, democratic region.
We're talking to Spencer Ackerman, who is assistant editor at The New Republic. His piece is called The Radical Mind of Dick Cheney. So you look at the last 10 years. Talk about Wolfowitz and Cheney.
They had a very interesting relationship. Both men have, it's somewhat overlooked, both men have in fact rather similar backgrounds. They're both academics. They've both spent their lives thinking very seriously about defense policy. They both evince something of a meritocratic idea, sort of finding bright young intellectuals who are willing to challenge the received wisdom and place them in important policymaking places. And that came to its germination in the first Bush administration. Cheney was Secretary of Defense. Paul Wolfowitz was Cheney's policy director, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And over that time, Cheney saw his policy shop run by Wolfowitz as less of a 400-man unit that would think about basing rights and weapons procurement and formulating military to military ties with other countries, and more of an incubator for really strategic ideas. And this was something that Wolfowitz was very keen on. There's a document that comes out of Wolfowitz's policy shop in 1992 called the Defense Planning Guidance that was very controversial and eventually becomes the 1993 Regional Defense Strategy. That was the first time a document for American policymakers spelled out circumstances under which it would be justified to undertake preventive military action, in this case, to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. You know, what does that sound like right now? Similarly, Wolfowitz saw that with this defense planning guidance that with the end of the Soviet Union and the birth of what we now call the unipolar moment would be a unique opportunity for America to exercise its ability to intervene in other moments of foreign policy crises with a lot greater freedom than it would during this period of ideological confrontation. Similarly, Wolfowitz advocated that if America shrink from its rather dominant role on the world stage, then the ideological gains of the Cold War would be perhaps momentary and fleeting, and so America needed to stay with its presence on the world stage as what it was in order to encourage that these gains, particularly he was thinking more in Eastern Europe at this point, would sort of be locked in. And finally, that America had to retain its very robust military capabilities to make sure that no rival emerged to challenge the United States over this period. And this was just simply not something that was really on the radar in 1992. It was not something that anyone was really thinking about at that time. People were expecting a peace dividend in the Cold War. The 1992 election was all about domestic politics, domestic problems, solving longstanding domestic issues. And so it caused a great deal of controversy. The first Bush administration, when the White House heard about it, they repudiated it. But an interesting thing happened, which is that Cheney, while he did accede to White House pressure and sand down its edges and make sure it got leaked to the same people the original draft got leaked to so that people could see it was no longer quite so aggressive, nevertheless, he retained most of its key ideas, most importantly about the necessity at times for preventive action and a forward-leaning military presence, and most importantly, this idea that American security was really dependent on what he called zones of democracy, different areas around the world which were former security threats, which through American intervention could be transformed into sort of democratic outposts. That's all retained in a January 1993 document called the Defense Plan. I'm sorry, called the Regional Defense Strategy. And so it really shows that the alliance between Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney wasn't sort of a marriage of convenience. It was really more of a meeting of two minds, people who really did see the world in a very similar way and were very eager to, you know, see that their vision was implemented.
We're talking to Spencer Ackerman. You talk about Dick Cheney leaving his position as defense secretary to become head of Halliburton, and how he how his disgust with the CIA led him to hire retired intelligence people, a policy he has carried on through this day. Can you talk about the kind of brain trust he set up at Halliburton to deal with the world, to deal with countries?
Well, basically, he comes out of the first Gulf War with a really acute sense, and so does Paul Wolfowitz, and so do others who work in the Pentagon, with a really acute sense that in many very important respects, the American intelligence establishment has failed. It's failed to see that the Soviet Union had a bioweapons program that we only found out about that in September of 1992 because Boris Yeltsin just flat out told us. And, you know, the Soviet Union was the whole reason, more or less, that the CIA existed. So how could they have missed something so important? Very, very few analysts in the intelligence community accurately predicted the invasion of Kuwait and so on. There were several failures that proved to be somewhat seminal. And by the time Cheney gets to Halliburton, like any businessman, he wants to have the most accurate information he can. And so as he hires people who have been former intelligence professionals and others to sort of help him with his forecasting as he ran the company, we talked to one of them, and this person told us that in very florid and not perhaps broadcastable language, how angry Cheney was at the CIA and how little faith he had in it. And by the time that Cheney becomes vice president, that's a deeply held belief that he carries over with him, and it's what leads Cheney and his bureaucratic allies to set up channels within the government to sort of second-guess, challenge, outsource, and almost replace the judgments of the established intelligence community.
Talk about his relationship with Ahmed Chalabi.
Chalabi, in the 1990s, as he goes through his period where he falls out of favor with the Clinton administration and with the Clinton administration's CIA, cultivates more and more contacts in Washington among conservatives, importantly Richard Perle and other scholars and former defense officials and other government officials who end up at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. And that's where Cheney goes after his stay as Secretary of Defense and before he becomes head of Halliburton. And through annual conferences that AEI would set up in Beaver Creek and elsewhere, Cheney comes to meet Chalabi, and it's at these conferences where Chalabi would be making his case that if only the U.S. would support the Iraqi National Congress and its insurgents, a democratic Iraq could very easily flow out of a very brief period of uprising and instability and the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. So at that point, it becomes more and more enticing to more and more people, the idea that you can be rid of this hideous dictator who seems to be addicted to weapons of mass destruction, who seems to have regional designs on the Middle East even after the Gulf War, and who seems to be sort of a relentless enemy of the United States, replaced with a democratic and free Iraq, which is sort of the bargain of all bargains. And by the time that Cheney becomes vice president, not only does he sort of keep an open line to Chalabi, but many of the people on his staff, including his chief of staff, Scooter Libby, one of his foreign policy advisors, John Hanna, another of his foreign policy advisors who goes over to work in the Pentagon later on, Bill Lutie. A lot of these people have established ties to Chalabi and to other Iraqi exiles, and they keep an open line within the vice president to listen to Chalabi, to solicit his advice, on some cases, to sort of get Chalabi's perspective on intelligence or get alternative intelligence analyses.
And the whole issue of Joe Wilson and the information that the information was false about the yellowcake uranium being sold to Iraq. Can you talk about Alan Foley, the director of the CIA's Nonproliferation Center, and what Cheney and Scooter Libby and the others were doing with him?
Foley runs perhaps one of the most, he's retiring now. He ran one of the most important directorates at the CIA in this day and age, which is about weapons proliferation. And over the course of 2002, there were several visits undertaken, both by Cheney personally, by Cheney's chief of staff, Scooter Libby, and then there were simply reams of other questioning of documents that would come out of the directorate to sort of as people who work for Foley have made clear had the effect of something of a chill factor that they got the impression that Cheney and his office wanted intelligence reports to conform to what they consider to be the proper conception of the threat, which is Saddam Hussein having reconstituted his nuclear weapons program. And with the Niger issue, a lot of that remains murky. Basically, the CIA felt it in early 2002, there's a report that makes its way to Dick Cheney that appears to have originated with Italian intelligence about Saddam seeking yellowcake uranium from Niger. And Cheney asks the CIA in early 2002, "Do you have anything to corroborate this? Do you have any further information? How accurate is it?" The CIA said they didn't know. They wanted someone to find out because they considered it of sufficient importance, both on its own merits and of such importance to the vice president that it deserved a fuller answer. They asked Joe Wilson, who had been an ambassador to several countries in Africa and had been an Africa specialist on the Clinton National Security Council, to go to Niger, check it out. Wilson went in February of 2002. Concluded that because of various bureaucratic strictures, because of the structure of the Niger uranium industry, it's run by two French-led consortiums in particular, and because of the difficulties in spiriting away uranium or making deals out in the open on uranium without attracting oversight, most importantly by the International Atomic Energy Agency, such a deal almost certainly did not occur. Wilson returns to the United States. He briefs his CIA contact, and that's sort of as far as he hears. Cheney's office is adamant that they did not know about Wilson's trip, that they did not know until they read about it in the papers just this summer that this trip had occurred, and they thought that the CIA had answered the questions from the vice president's office in its entirety in 2002.
Finally, you talk about Cheney citing a Zogby poll opposing those who said there was not support on the ground in Iraq by citing this poll to say that the Iraqi people were with the U.S. military. Can you talk about that?
This was one of the most bizarre statements Cheney made, both before the war, during the war, and in the post-war. In August, the Zogby organization tried to conduct the first scientific, as they call it, understanding of Iraqi public opinion. And what they found was decidedly not good for the United States. Sure enough, they found overwhelmingly that the Iraqi people, as any oppressed people would be, were overjoyed to be rid of Saddam Hussein. That did not translate into an overwhelming endorsement of the coalition's occupation. Cheney took the findings on television and spun it in a way that suggested that was exactly what Zogby had found, and it was used by Cheney as a way to vindicate the coalition action. Yet Zogby, when you analyze the poll, just paints such an overwhelmingly different picture. It's very strange. Cheney had said that the American model of government was the most popular among the Iraqis. In fact, a breakaway plurality of 49% wanted a democratic state that was guided by Islamic law. The closest choice to the United States model, which was a secular and democratic Iraq, garnered, by contrast, only 21% support. Cheney had said that about 60% of Iraqis wanted to stay for at least another year. In fact, what they had said was they wanted the United States to leave in a year. And when you look at just the Sunni population of Iraq, that figure is at 70%. And they about half of Iraqis said that they expected the United States over the next 5 years to be harmful to their country. So I think a fair reading of the poll would probably say that Iraqis have somewhat mixed to negative feelings at the point at which Zogby conducted the poll about the American occupation. It was quite far from the enthusiastic reception that Cheney told the public that Iraqis had on Meet the Press.
Spencer Ackerman, I want to thank you for being with us. Spencer Ackerman is co-author of the piece, What Dick Cheney Really Believes, The Radical. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us.
Our world has begun to spin like a Ferris wheel. The threat of world annihilation is getting very real. And what a hope and happiness. Are they forever lost? Or will that step in and prevent another Holocaust? Oh, everybody better wake up. Everybody better wake up. The superpowers better wake up. The world powers better wake up.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, Neville Brothers Wake Up. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush signed a $401 billion defense authorization bill Monday, saying America's military is standing between our country and grave danger. We face enemies that measure their progress by the chaos they inflict, the fear they spread, and the innocent lives they destroy. Tucked away within the bill is $15 million for continued research into new H-bombs, including low-yield so-called mini-nukes. The bill lifts a decade-old ban on research into low-yield nuclear weapons. Japanese officials expressed concern yesterday about the plan, saying it could have, quote, a negative impact on nuclear proliferation, non-proliferation. The U.S. is the only country in history to have dropped an atomic bomb. In 1945, it dropped one on the city of Hiroshima, one on Nagasaki. Greg Mello is on the line with us right now, executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. Can you talk about a story that's almost uncovered now? What about the money that has been allocated for mini nukes?
Yes. I think that this is kind of a green light for those forces in the U.S. nuclear weapons complex that have been restrained for quite some time. They want new weapons. They need new weapons to grease the managerial wheels in the weapons complex to recruit, to retain staff, to have a kind of rational management structure within the very large weapons complex that we've built up over the last 8 years or so. So they will see this as a kind of a vindication of their long efforts to say that nuclear weapons are legitimate war-fighting weapons, along with others, and that we need to pursue a differentiated so-called deterrent, or really, as some people are starting to call it, compellence, in order to pursue U.S. goals around the world.
If the bill lifts a decade-old ban on research into low-yield nuclear weapons, how does it say that it's for continued research?
Well, these programs really started under the Clinton administration. The stage was kind of set. There were exploratory studies. There were military requirements and studies going on. And now in the Bush administration, first we had the doctrine, the nuclear posture review and related documents, and now the actual authorization from Congress to go ahead and undertake the initial design of these kinds of weapons. It must be said that all of the weapons in the U.S. arsenal could be adapted as mini nukes with very little effort. But to tailor them to particular delivery systems or to the new kinds of targets that are being looked at is more work.
What companies benefit from this?
The University of California is certainly the world's best-funded designer and manufacturer of weapons of mass destruction, running two of the nation's nuclear weapons laboratories. Lockheed Martin is probably the next. Then there's a whole, there's kind of a little specialized group of nuclear contractors that are quite political, and I think, they have obscure names. There's also an interesting connection between the U.S. and the British contractors. Lockheed Martin also helps run the British nuclear weapons program.
We're talking to Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group. The connection between this and the Pentagon's plans to create a hypersonic strike force that can hit anywhere in the world within 2 hours.
Yes. This is really very much underreported. Along with the proposals and early work on new warheads, there is a broad-ranging effort to upgrade the missiles on which the warheads are carried. And this has not been the subject of congressional debate. No one seems to care about enormous increases in accuracy, range, flexibility, in-flight intelligence gathering about targets. Some of these capabilities are expected to be flight tested in later in this decade. Basically, the whole missile system is in line for a major upgrade.
And what this means for relations with the Japanese?
Well, relations with everyone, really. The central international law regarding nonproliferation and is the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which has existed with a state of internal tension. The treaty would prevent the proliferation of nuclear weapons. It also requires the nuclear weapons states to undertake negotiations in good faith for nuclear disarmament. The United States and the other, less so the other nuclear weapons states, have been reluctant to go to the NPT regime and strengthen it because there's considerable dismay about the double standard in the NPT, the lack of enforcement of Article 6, which requires disarmament by the nuclear weapons states. And so the result has been an erosion of the NPT regime, which I think many people are fearing regional nuclear arms races, certainly in East Asia.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Greg Mello, with the Los Alamos Study Group. Finally, just asking you, what are you planning to do about this research and activist group in Los Alamos, where the atomic bomb was created?
There are two important things. One is to try to get the word out, as it were. These stories are very underreported. People don't understand them. The second is that citizens, we are organizing here, and there are. It's important for citizens to realize that these treaties come out of their own aspirations, out of their own security needs, and I think around the weapons complex, we are going to see an increase in citizen involvement, citizen activism, because the impacts of these activities occur in those communities, first of all. I think that we can't just wait for what happens in Congress, because the opposition there has been a little bit late and a little bit weak.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Greg Mello of the Los Alamos Study Group. As we move to what happened in Florida. United Steelworkers of America calling for the firing of the Miami Police Chief John Timoney after the police response to the protests against the Free Trade Area of the Americas. The protests marred by scores of reports of police brutality. The president of the steelworkers calling for a congressional investigation into why $8.5 million from the Iraq Reconstruction Bill was used to pay for, quote, security at the protests. He said the money went towards homeland repression. We're joined on the phone right now by Marco Turbovich, who is a spokesperson for the United Steelworkers of America. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Can you tell us exactly what you're calling for now?
Well, we're calling for a congressional investigation into what was clearly a police state, which resulted in assaults on people who were peacefully protesting. The reason we're appealing to Congress is not widely known outside Miami, but $8.5 million was earmarked in the $87 billion for the reconstruction of Iraq. $8.5 million of that money was diverted to security in Florida. What that money was used for was to create an armed camp there, really to suppress people's right to free assembly and to freely petition their government on the grievances we have with the trade policies of this country. It was astounding what was there. There were phalanxes of armed riot police that stretched for blocks and blocks and blocks. There were police cars parked bumper to bumper for blocks on end. There were armored personnel carriers. Some of them poised. One of them in particular that was particularly outraged me as a veteran of 4 years of Navy service was an armored personnel carrier parked within about 10 yards of the entrance to the AFL-CIO rally at the Bayfront Park Amphitheater on Thursday. You don't need to have served this country's military and been a citizen in good standing to have our own government pointing weapons of that size and force at us, clearly to intimidate us. I mean, there's no question in my mind they had no intention of shooting those weapons, but they were clearly designed to intimidate. But a number of people suffered injury because of the abusive behavior of the police. They were very aggressive. They squeezed people into narrow cordons to enter the facilities that we were entitled to use. And then they gratuitously arrested people, and they arrested a number of our members. including one of our parade marshals, who clearly had a very bright parade marshal T-shirt on, and one of the secretaries from the headquarters in Pittsburgh, among others. These people were walking down the street to go back to their hotel, and there were police at every intersection. And at one intersection, they stopped them, and they said, you have to go left here. So they followed those instructions and went about 50 yards, and they were pounced upon by a small posse of police in riot gear, told to go to the ground, were handcuffed, were forced to remain in handcuffs for as long as 6 hours in the case of the secretary, even while going to the lavatory while in police custody. There was a woman at the amphitheater who was the wife of one of our steelworker retirees, who was merely in the wrong place at the wrong time as the police assaulted a student, and who was there and trying to enter the facility, and because she got in the way, quote unquote, she was thrown to the ground and a gun was put to her head. Gretchen Gordon, who is the co-director of Citizens Trade Campaign, a well-known anti-globalization organization in Washington, D.C. This is a woman who's well known in Congress, who walks the halls of Congress freely. She was twice thrown to the ground and had guns pointed to the back of her head. So it was just an appalling level of force present and used, all to deny us the right of free assembly or the right of unfettered assembly in this case.
The Miami Herald is reporting today Miami police reneged on their promise to give safe passage to 25 busloads of seniors who attempted to attend Thursday's AFL-CIO rally against the free trade area of the Americas. Tony Fancetta, president of the Florida Alliance for Retired Americans, said 13 of the busloads were turned away, many of the others diverted, forcing senior citizens to walk up to 2 miles to attend the permitted rally at Bayfront Amphitheater. Bentley Kilman is one of those who did make it to the protest, 71-year-old retired airline pilot. Can you talk about what happened to you?
Yes, ma'am. What happened as I was, what caused my arrest, as the gentleman indicated, we were going north on one of the avenues, the streets, whichever, and we were trying to get to one of the buses that would carry us back to Fort Myers. We ran into a phalanx line of what I would call brown shirts, and we told them that we wished to go to the west so I could get on a bus, and they directed us down the alley of the railroad tracks that the gentleman indicated. And as he indicated, we got down about halfway, a quarter way, and I saw that the black shirts were coming, sweeping around the corner. It was, again, it was a phalanx. They were armed to arm with shields, clubs, and guns. And I could see that they were arresting the people ahead of us. So we stood there. Rather than create any problem, we did not run. We did not make any physical or vocal opposition. We just stood there. My partner, who was with the Alliance, he was on his cell phone. He had a clearly marked vest that showed he was a staff of the situation. And they came up to it. We saw them put others on the ground, arrest them, handcuff them. We were then standing there, and the black shirts came up, came up to us, and put with guns pointed in our direction. About a stomp, they asked us to get on the ground, and when I got on my knees, either a knee or a foot was put in my back, and I was forced to the ground. And they handcuffed me, and I stayed in handcuffs behind my back for 7.5 hours, and I was 18 hours before I got to a phone for anything.
Did you get any water?
I was handcuffed about 5 p.m. I finally got water. I finally was hydrated about 3:45 the next morning. About going on it.
Marco Turbevich.
Yeah, you know, the nature of these incidents, it's very hard not to conclude that the police felt compelled to make some arrests in order to vindicate the expenditure of millions of dollars for what was an inherently peaceful protest.
We're going to go to a break. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Global Exchange. She's headed to Iraq. She was at the protests, had guns pointed at her head. Marco Turbovich, a spokesman for the United Steelworkers of America. Bentley Kilman, 71-year-old retired airline pilot, arrested, held for many hours, hands handcuffed behind his back. Also, a reminder, our own Anna Noguera, Democracy Now! Producer, was also arrested as she was filming the protests. The police asking each other as they were about to arrest her, is she with us? There were embedded reporters with the Miami Police Department, as they are on the front lines of Iraq. When they concluded she was not an embedded reporter, they handcuffed her, and she was held for many hours. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us.
Telling me somebody's been picking in my cherry tree. Don't want a bitch just right by mistake, but I could tell someone's been digging around in my cave.
Stevie Wonder, I ain't going to stand for it here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about what the Steelworkers American or the Alliance for Retired Americans and others are calling for right now, coming out of the police response to the FTA protests. Hearing from Marco Turbovich saying he believes that the police cracked down in the way they did to justify the $8.5 million that Miami Police Department got out of the $87 billion Iraq reconstruction bill to deal with these protests. Medea Benjamin on the line with us, co-founder of Global Exchange. Medea, you were at the FTA protests. What happened to you? Do these stories you're hearing sound familiar?
Well, of course they do, Amy. And I was on my way home one evening, and we were in a van, got stopped by about 12 police with guns put to our heads, forced out of the car, frisked, held every piece of paper in the van, gone through, and no markings on the police. They wouldn't tell us their names. They wouldn't tell us who they were with. They would tell us who was in charge. And as we kept complaining and yelling and they kept threatening us, finally one of them took me over to show me the booty they had collected from other cars. And they said, look, the reason we have to search everybody is because we came up with this. And this was two hockey sticks and a baseball bat and one slingshot. They spent about $600 per protester on repressive tactics. And my sense is that the real aim was to equate protesters with terrorists and to make the people of Miami feel that the use of helicopters, of tanks in the streets, of robocops in full riot gear, is really an attempt to make people feel that this is an appropriate response to the exercise of people's First Amendment rights, to make people get used to feeling this level of repression is, quote, in their own interest. And that's why it's so important that we fight against this.
Finally, Marco Turbovich, what are you calling for right now? What are you demanding?
Well, we're demanding an investigation by the Congress into the police comportment in Miami.
Do you think that's realistic?
Well, I don't know whether it's realistic. It's absolutely necessary. You cannot let things like this pass without challenging them, particularly when your tax dollars are being used to repress you. And so there's no question that this needs to be pursued. Whether or not it will be pursued will be up to Congress. I don't know that. I do want to say, Amy, I think part of the reason for this are the reasons that Medea cited. Also, I think we're winning. I think those of us who are challenging these bankrupt trading policies, which are hollowing out this economy and destroying good-paying and particularly union jobs, I think we're winning. because they're backpedaling on these policies. And I think there's sort of an inverse relationship, correlation between the extent to which we're winning and the extent to which there's a certain desperate need to characterize us as somehow evil or terroristic. So, so on the one hand, it's appalling and outraging. On the other hand, I'm somewhat encouraged that that the FTAA framework that was announced there is sheer mockery. It's an empty shell, and they cannot any longer hide the fact that these trade agreements and their enforcement through the International Monetary Fund are creating riots throughout South America. I mean, 10 million people in Brazil voted against the IMF's policies, so they can't hide this under a bushel basket any longer.
Marco Turbovich, spokesman for the United Steelworkers of America, Bentley Kilman, retired airline pilot who was arrested. Medea Benjamin with us from Global Exchange. As we turn now, Medea, to a trip you'll be taking with families of those who are now in Iraq, U.S. servicemen and women. Can you describe the trip as we turn to Sean Daugherty, Vietnam veteran whose 24-year-old daughter Kelly is now serving in Iraq, and Stan Goff, author of Hideous Dream, a soldier's memoir of the U.S. invasion of Haiti. Also, his child is in Iraq.
Well, we have an amazing group of 10 people going with us. Seven of them are family members with loved ones either serving in Iraq right now or who have had their family members killed serving in Iraq. And the other three are Vietnam vets or vets of the Gulf War. It's pretty remarkable that we were able to put this kind of group together, given the pressure that some of these people are now getting not to go on the trip. But we are determined to leave. We're going on Saturday. We will be in Baghdad until December 9th, and then we have plans while we're there. We've asked to meet with the head of the U.S. Civilian Authority, Paul Bremer. We've asked to meet with the head of the military, who has already said he won't meet with us. But most important probably for the people who are going on this trip is, one, to meet with the troops, and two, to meet with ordinary Iraqis and get a sense of what is really going on there and what are some real possible solutions to the mess that the Bush administration has got us into.
Sean Daugherty, you're a Vietnam vet. Your 24-year-old daughter is in Iraq. Can you tell us what she has been communicating to you? Has she been writing?
Yes. She's been writing me on a regular basis. One of the things that she said in one of her letters was quite a while back. She said that, I thought I was going home in May, and then it was July, and now it's August, and I guess I'll just keep on liberating the Iraqis from the tyranny of their oil, while Americans back home can drive their yellow Hummers and fly the American flag to show support for their troops. What irony. She has to cope, you know, with a lot of stress. I mean, she went over there with the mistaken assumption she was only going to be there for perhaps 4 or 5 months, and now it's stretching into 9.
How old is she?
She's 24.
Yeah. Stan Goff, you have a son in the Gulf?
I do.
How old is he?
He's 20.
And what have you heard from him?
He has access to email, fortunately, so about three times a week we've been hearing from him, sometimes with a phone call and sometimes with email, so we've got a pretty good snapshot on Ramadi, at least. He's a pretty apolitical kid, but he said they don't need to be there. I mean, and that's the sense especially of a lot of support troops. Many of them are sitting around idle right now because of the just incredible mismatch between military doctrine and the situation that actually exists there right now.
Stan Goff, you have circulated an open letter to GIs. You yourself have served for many years. You were Special Forces. You were in a number of places around the world. What are you saying to GIs in this country?
Well, one of the things that we really want to sort of push as a message into Iraq right now, as this thing goes on, there are going to be some changes. in the personalities of the people who are involved, particularly the combat troops who are actually experiencing combat and involved in, you know, some of the more horrendous things that we sort of hear about through the press. And PTSD is not the least of these. Post-traumatic stress disorder can manifest itself in a lot of ways, occasionally even in ways that appear to be very sociopathic. And this is an experience that a lot of Vietnam veterans remember, the difficulty adapting, the kinds of feelings people have associated with guilt over things that they did under peer pressure and command pressure while they were in theater. And so we're just really encouraging people to keep that in the front of their mind while they're over there. That was what the open letter to the GIs was about, was hold on to your humanity, and that there's a terrible cost that you pay as an occupier for executing what some people try to portray to you as your duty against the occupied. It's not just collateral damage among the civilian population, but there's collateral damage that gets sent back home. Families become collateral damage when these folks come back, and they can't get their heads around the experience that they've been involved in. And a lot of times they've done things themselves that they have to live with for the rest of their lives. And so we're kind of trying to preempt that a little bit and tell people, you do not have to follow the legal orders. You are not required to hate Iraqis. Be careful not to buy into the sort of inevitable racism that grows up around the situation of occupation. So, you know, that's our main message right now, is hold on to your humanity and beware that you don't drift into things that are clearly illegal.
Sean Daugherty, your daughter came home for 2 weeks for a break. Did she have to pay for her flight to come home?
Yes, she did.
Soldiers have to pay to come home?
Yeah, apparently they'll fly them to Cleveland. But that doesn't do them any good because, for one thing, they don't get ahead of time notice, so that the ticket is a, you know, 24-hour notice type ticket. And she felt that it would cost, someone told her that it would apparently cost her as much or more if she was flown to Cleveland and had to pay her way to San Francisco, so she simply purchased her ticket in Kuwait and flew from there.
You encouraged her not to return?
Yes, I did.
Would that be going AWOL?
She's my daughter. I don't want to see her in harm's way. It's a pretty basic thing with me, you know, and I was in Vietnam, and I know what a waste that was. I talked to a lawyer with Military Family Speak Out, and he advised me and her both that if you are already in the military, you have no civilian representation. You were not tried in a civilian court, and therefore you're pretty much out of luck. And so, of course, it was her decision to make, you know, and not mine. And, of course, she didn't want to be a fugitive from justice, and if she comes out of this, okay, you know, she's only got one semester remaining in college, and hopefully a bright future ahead of her.
Well, Sean Daugherty and Stan Goff, I hope to continue to talk to you as your children remain in the Gulf. Sean Daugherty, Vietnam vet, 24-year-old daughter Kelly is in the Gulf, and Stan Goff's son is in Iraq. That does it for today's program. If you want to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. democracynow.org is our website. You can go there, sign up for our email daily digest. Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pravesh Sharma are our producers. Mike DeFilippo, Rich Kim, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.